Episode 285 of the Pilot Podcast takes off now. Fly with Garmin Avionics, then grab your mobile device and make the Garmin Pilot app your cockpit companion. Get advanced functions you'll use before, during, and after every flight, including updating your aircraft's databases and logging engine data. Plan, file, fly, log with Garmin Pilot.
The Pilot to Pilot Podcast is brought to you by Learn the Finer Points. Use the link below to save 10% off their ground school app.
Dave Keyes, I'm the chief pilot for Peace River Citrus Products. We have a one airplane, two pilot flight department. I've been in aviation. I started in 1975 at Embry-Riddle and turned 65 last year, but still have my passion. So live in Florida, grew up in Pennsylvania in the Pittsburgh area. So diehard Steelers fan.
Avy Nation, what is going on? And welcome back to the Pilot to Pilot Podcast. My name is Justin Seams and I am your host. Today's episode is with Dave Keyes. Now, Dave Keyes has pretty much done everything you could ever imagine. Corporate pilot, CFB AA president, vice chair MBAA domestic operations committee, and founded MBAA small flight department committee. Like, that sounds like a breath hold. I'm losing my breath just talking about it, but it was great to have Dave on the podcast. He has such great knowledge when it comes to corporate aviation, and he has flown everything, as you're going to listen to in this episode. So if you're thinking about airlines, thinking about corporate, thinking about doing some other kind of things, this is the episode for you. It is really going to make you think about what you want, and maybe airline flying isn't for you, or maybe corporate's not for you. But listen to what Dave has to say, because he has a lot of great knowledge. If you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review. 5 stars would be great, but go to Spotify or iTunes and leave a review. The more reviews and the more stars that there are, the more likely this episode or this podcast will be recommended on those platforms. So that is the best thing that you can do to help. We're also coming out with a website soon, pilotthepilothq.com. I hope it's up and running by this episode, but if not, hopefully it'll be here anytime soon. Also, check out the Bold Aviator hats. You can go to boldaviator.com, search Pilot the Pilot, and you can find the best aviation hat that there is. They also have some other good swag as well, but the Pilot the Pilot hat is by far the best. Avy Nation, I don't want to keep you any longer. So without any further ado, here's Dave Keyes. Dave, what's going on? Welcome to the Pilot Podcast.
Hi, just how are you?
I'm doing good. I was excited to talk to you until you told me you're a diehard Steeler fan. You know, I think that's the end of the conversation. We can't do it anymore.
That's it, right? That's it. People say, but we travel well.
Yeah, Steelers, y'all do travel well. I am from Charlotte, North Carolina, diehard Panther fan for better or for worse. Right. And anytime Pittsburgh's playing, there's more Steeler fans than there are Panther fans. So it's an annoyance, man.
Well, it depends on what side you're on,
right? Yeah, right. Well, cool. We're not here to talk about football. Maybe I'll start another podcast one day and get into football. But I want to talk about you. I want to talk about your story. The first question I ask everyone is usually the same. It's why aviation? What was inspiration to get you into this crazy industry?
Right. And like most of your people, there's not a definitive answer. My father, none of my family were pilots, but a grandfather on my father's side, who I never knew, he died the year I was born, was in the railroad business. So I think I got my transportation gene from him, but I always loved airplanes as a kid. I would write manufacturers and get pamphlets and build models and just drag my dad to the airport so I could watch airplanes. So I've always had an interest. It's what I've always wanted to do. So I was fortunate because I think that helped guide my life, make decisions when I was young. I'm not going to go get in trouble because I may not be able to fly. So it's just been a passion and I've loved it. I've got to do what I love every day, which is very fortunate.
Yeah, absolutely. So how does one kind of have and find the love for aviation and turn it into a career or turn it into kind of an actionable step to go for it? Because, you know, a lot of people, when you tell them you're a pilot, like, oh man, I love planes. Like, I wish I would have been a pilot. But the difference is between you two is that you actually took the steps and set up your career or set up your life to kind of do this. So what did you do to make it happen?
Well, I was fortunate that I received an ROTC scholarship to go to Embry-Riddle in Daytona. So I moved here in 75. And unfortunately, some bad decisions, but also at the end of the Vietnam War, the military was not taking any pilots. So Air Force paid for most of my schooling, and then I got out and did not have a military opportunity. Some of the fellas that I was in school with did. I think what I tell folks, because I run into a lot of people that say, yeah, I'd love to be a pilot, is go take lessons. Go see if it's something that clicks with you, because until you do that, you don't know if you're going to love it. And I've had people come back and go, oh, that was horrible. They did a stall and I just can't take that. And where those of us that love it, it's like, hey, all right, we did a stall. Let's do a spin. let's see how much fun we can have with this. And back, I think training was different back in the 70s. We had a lot more freedom. There was an ADS-B to track everything we did. So solo flights would turn into adventures with our friends. And as long as we brought the airplane back safely and nobody reported on us, we got away with it. So that just really fed into my passion for it.
It was a lot easier to get lost back then too.
Oh, good Lord. I know. I would do cross countries across Florida or up into the Southeast, and I'd go, I have no idea where I am, but just keep flying. Yeah. Let's see where this leads.
Yeah, I know, right? It's like, why am I been over water for so long?
Exactly. We did not have GPSs. Yeah. We did not have movie maps. We had just what a sectional chart looking at the ground like, oh, okay, is that a water tank? I don't know.
I know. I feel like a lot of pilots now who are learning on G1000 don't understand the fear of, is that the right road track? Or is like this, I should be here, but I'm like just the unknown of where you are in your first solo cross country and just like the fear that you either went too far or missed a point or, you know, it's real because a lot of people get lost and you hear a lot of horror stories like calling ATC, be like, I don't know where I am.
Right. Or getting a DF steer. I remember those days. You call flight service and they would, you know, but the good thing about learning to fly in Florida, you can fly east or west. You know, eventually you're going to hit water.
Yeah. And there's a million airports there. So it's like, okay, let's just go here.
Just land and ask somebody, where am I? And I've done that before, but that was the early days. It's funny how I think aviation is, it's almost like a gene. You run into people that just, it's what they bought. I have a nephew who's now a Delta pilot. And he, when he was young, he would just call me and I'd send him all kinds of airplane stuff. So he had it early on too. Now my brother, you know, would hates me for it, but
can't blame him, honestly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Although he's had one of those, stellar careers where he went to Emory Riddle Prescott, graduated flight instructor, went to, PSA, became a captain, went right into Delta. And I tell him, I said, you've missed a lot of what aviation has to offer. It's a great career path and you're going to make a lot of money, but I got into this for adventure and fun. And I'm telling you, I've had it. It's just been such a rewarding time. I've not made the most money, but it's always been there when I needed it.
You know, it's interesting you say that because back when, even when I was doing my training, so I started my training in 2010. So pretty soon after the Great Recession, and it was not a good time to get in aviation. And when you were doing your training, I mean, maybe it wasn't as bad as, I mean, getting jobs is still hard, right? Like flight instructors didn't make 60, 70 grand. You weren't going to a regional making 100 grand. You were going to regional, you're on food stamps. You're sleeping on benches. I've had a
couple of people. You were paying to go to regionals.
Exactly. You were paying. You had to have like 5,000 to 6,000 hours just to get into the door. And that might even be enough. So now as a pilot, which is great, like I think this is amazing for financial reasons, they're coming in making a ton of money and that's amazing, but you are right. I'm sure there is a little bit of a miss on the adventure side. There's a little bit of a miss on the love for aviation and it could be turning it into more of just like a job essentially. But I mean, it is what it is, right? It's good for the money, but maybe not as good for the love of aviation and the adventure of it.
Exactly. And I hope the guys like my nephew that do it, that they take the money and spend it in exploring aviation outside of the airline and you know, buy an airplane or get in a flying club and just go out and enjoy it. Because I've been fortunate that I've touched every aspect of aviation, from cargo to charter to fractional to private to airline to airlines. So I've seen it all, and I'm telling you, it's been an adventure.
No, it's definitely an adventure, which is great. So you said you touched everything. Kind of tell me about, I guess we'll go back to, you were an ROTC in the military. There wasn't really an option for you to do aviation. So what was next?
Right, yeah, the military said, which was funny, they called us all in and said, we don't have pilot slots, but we can give you missileman slots. And we all looked at each other and said, no, we want to be pilots. So I left Emory Riddle, went to work for Westinghouse Electric. And here's a good question for you. Do you know what a Canadair CL-44 is?
I do not.
You'll have to Google it. That was my very first airplane, large airplane, other than the flight training. Westinghouse bought two of them to fly back and forth to Puerto Rico out of Florida to avert. Well, they were preparing for a dock worker strike, and they had a bunch of processing plants in Puerto Rico that would have shut them down. So they bought the airplane, set up a cargo operation. And I went to work for them. It was the worst airplane I've ever flown, but I cut my teeth on it. It was great. Eventually went to Miami. They closed down planes with the Miami, moved down to Miami and flew them all around the world, to Europe, to Asia, to Hong Kong, to everywhere. And at 18,000 feet, we crossed the Atlantic. But that was some of the best times. You talk about learning, and I learned so much from old scruffy captains that structured my bit. I had a guy, his name is Bill Fox, long gone, but he smoked like a chimney. That's back where you could smoke on airplanes. And we were in the middle of the Atlantic, headed to Europe on my first flight. And he looked over and he said, what do you do if you lose an engine on this thing at takeoff? And I'm like, okay. And I go through the procedures. And he goes, no. And I'm like, oh, crud. So I went through him again, and he goes, wrong. I looked at him and I said, well, Bill, I guess I'm missing something. I don't know what to do. He goes, do you smoke? And I said, no, I don't smoke. He goes, do you drink coffee? I said, well, yeah. He goes, you lose an engine in this thing, get up, get a cup of coffee, come and sit back down. Because if you get in a hurry, you're going to kill yourself. And that lesson always stuck with me. Like, don't get in a hurry in an airplane.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. I remember in flight safety, we were doing some engine fire work. And, you know, obviously engine fire comes on, like you really get into overdrive and you're like, all right, let's put this fire out. Cause fire in an airplane is not good. So, but they're like, hey, take your time. Like, pull out the checklist. Don't do anything rash. And it's just like, it almost seems counterintuitive, right? Like you want to act on it, but it's like, no, take your time. The worst thing you can do is act too fast and either shut down the wrong engine or hit the wrong buttons or do the wrong stuff. So he's spot on. And some of that stuff you can't learn in flight safety or in the simulator. Some of that stuff you learn from Bill, who's smoking a carton a day and just knows all the knowledge in the world about this one airplane.
Exactly. I laugh when I go to the doctors for my physical and they go, you smoke? And I said, I've never smoked a cigarette. My parents smoked out, turned me off. But I said, I have inhaled a lot of secondhand smoking over the years. So who knows? Well, anyway, so I flew that. We went to Miami. The cargo outfit got a contract back. That's when Night Freight was starting up with Emory Air Freight. So we ended up with Electras. I flew the Electra for a while. And then so we got 727s. And so that was a real learning curve to go into the jet. I was a co-pilot on the 7-2, great airplane. And we had hired a bunch of, Braniff had just folded up. So we hired a bunch of ex-Braniff captains. And that was an education because those gentlemen knew every nut, bolt, switch on that airplane. They could build you a 727. And I learned so much about, number one, that airplane, but also aviation. I mean, just and the how to fly airplanes. We would challenge ourselves because we'd be in the middle of the night headed out to Des Moines or Cedar Rapids or something. And the challenge was from top of descent to final approach, you could not touch the throttles. Whatever you set, that's what you had to have. And you had to manage the airplane to the final approach fix. I was horrible at it.
Yeah, so how long did it take you to figure that out?
I learned fairly quick, but those guys could do it in a heartbeat. Like, they would just put me to shame. And it was like, oh, so I would watch how they did it and try to emulate. But those are some of the challenges that we had, just the fun things. But it also taught you how to manage the airplane, how to manage, the flaps and the gear and the power and the...
Yeah.
It's a great learning curve.
Yeah. Glider, right?
How to manage exactly. You could pull one engine back. It was up to you how you wanted to do it. So anyway, I went from there. And then the airlines were hiring back in the 80s. This was the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s. There was a big resurgence and you didn't need 1,500 hours. They were hiring, the big story, United was hiring a lot of 500 hour female pilots and that, because they'd gotten hit with a EEOC lawsuit. And I had certainly a lot more than that by that time, but got on with Eastern Airlines. I could have gone with either American or Eastern, and Eastern did not have a B or did not have a B scale at the time. So I thought, oh, I'll go with Eastern Airlines. And I loved it. I was there for 5 years, walked the picket line until they shut down at the end. But what a great group. Once again, great group of people that I just learned a whole lot of aviation and flying knowledge from. There's just something about flying with these guys that had been around from, a lot of them were Korean War vets and had been military, but a lot of these folks fronted routes to all parts of the world. South America, Eastern is big in South America. So learned a lot about flying through South America without, GPS and all the toys we have today.
Sounds like a nightmare to me, honestly.
It was, you had to know what you're doing. Yeah. Eastern ended up putting a crash in a 7-2 in the mountain in La Paz. They've never recovered to this day. That was traumatic, obviously, for a lot of people, but it was a great airline, great people. Unfortunately, that was a horrible time in the airline industry then with Frank Lorenzo and crew coming in. Continental, he bought Eastern, and then and it was kind of bleeding the assets off to go to Continental, and so we went on strike and eventually went out of business. So then I found myself into the business aviation world, flying a Sabre liner for a company. Loved it. Two guys owned a company. We ended up there for 15 years, so all over the country, the Caribbean. They sold that, bought a Citation 7, and then so they sold the company. So airplane went, ended up with Citation Air, if you remember them.
Yeah, Citation. So is it Citation Jets or Citation Air?
Well, they were Citation Air, and then they went to Citation Shares. They changed
That's
their name.
That's what it was, yeah.
And really, once again, really good group of guys. Learned a 135 and the fractional. Then Textron figured out they made more money selling airplanes than operating them. So they closed down, sold off their airplanes. And
I think there's a little bit of pressure from the company I work at, too. I think they're like, hey, if you're competing with us, we're not going to buy your planes anymore. And they're like, oh, well, you're probably going to buy a ton of planes one day, so we will stop.
Exactly. Yeah. There was a lot of pressure. That was the word we got. Yeah. So, and it made sense.
Yeah.
Why would you buy from a competitor, right?
Exactly. Yeah. It's like, time out here. Exactly. We're going to be all Embraer here soon. I'm sure that's not what was said, but it's like, we have other options. So let us know how you want to play this.
Exactly. So yeah, it made sense, but I enjoyed my time there and it was a good job. I liked the stability of week on, week off. You could schedule. But anyway, I ended up back on the street. I did some work at Flight Safety Orlando, did some contract flying and some 135 flying, and then ended up with the company I'm currently with back then. They were buying an XL. They were buying a Citation XLS Plus, and they wanted to go to Europe for the Olympics. And the crew, their pilots had never been out of the country, so I had been obviously around the world. And they hired me. Replaced one of their guys who was leaving to go back to school, and ended up taking him to Europe in the XLS Plus. Had a great time, and ended up working full time for them. The chief pilot, he had heart issues, ended up having bypass surgery, and was out of the cockpit for quite a while. He actually came back after 15 months, and so I thought, well, I'll let him. I'd been running the department. He came back. I left to go to Southwest. I had a bunch of friends from Eastern days and everything. And said, hey, why don't you come to Southwest? I had a 737 typewriter from back in the 80s, I guess. I got one. And so I went to Southwest. I was 57 then. I thought, they're not going to hire me. And they sent him my stuff. And they called the next day and said, yeah, we want to interview you. So I thought, okay. And I was going to stay there, and about 6 months in, the boss of the owner of this company, really great guy, wanted to make a change. The old chief pilot wasn't working out. Called me up and said, I want you to come back. And I told him, I've got a job I'm pretty happy with. And back and forth. And he finally said, you tell me what it'll take for you to come back. So I said, all right, sat down and figured out financially what it would take so I wouldn't really lose any money from being Southwest. And in addition, I said, but I need a contract that, I'm going to get paid till I'm 65, whether you sell the airplane, whether whatever happens. And he agreed to it. He said, that makes perfect sense. So I've encouraged people that, you know, when the people are negotiating, especially in the business aviation world, I said, think a little outside of the box. You know, you hear training contracts, but what about an employment contract that say, you know, I'll come to work for you, but I want a 5-year contract that should something happen that I'm going to get paid for 5 years. I'm not a year into this and you sell the airplane and I'm out of a job. I've had several people go, that's a great idea. I never thought of that.
Yeah, that is a good idea. The problem with that, I mean, maybe it works better now. I mean, even when you were in your situation, but I feel like in the past, there's been a lot of, you know, how companies kind of rule the pilot market. They can kind of set the standards like, all right, well, I'm not going to agree to that because I could hire anyone else for, there's 100 people that are waiting to fly this airplane, you know, where now it's a little bit harder to hire them. So pilots have a little bit more leeway and have a little bit more negotiation power on the business side.
Well, exactly. And if it's a good company with a good fit, they're going to be willing to, they want to keep you because especially in today's market, as you said, it's crazy. But over the last 10 years, even then there has been some back and forth because a company, it costs roughly $250,000 to replace a pilot by the time you figure training, moving expenses. And so we've over the work I've done, we've tried to convince business aviation operators that, you know, if you've got a good flight department, you want to keep them. You want to figure out how to retain them because it's going to cost you a lot of money to replace one or two pilots that walk out the door.
Yeah. And with some of the stuff, we'll get into this a bit later, but one question about that, and you're advising maybe companies and stuff, how do you advise them to keep up with salaries or to keep up with these contracts that are going on right now? Because not all small companies can afford to pay what you can make at Southwest, United, American, Delta, the fractionals, you know, how do you advise them to keep up with that? Is it maybe offer, it's like you said, think outside the box, like offer something other than total maybe total compensation, not necessarily just salary, but other aspects to the job as well that you can provide.
Right. And I that's been a huge conversation in the industry over the last couple of years. Dr. Chris Broyhill has, if you get a chance to talk to him, has a company that does salary surveys, and he's all of his data is pretty up to date versus like an annual salary survey. So that's the first starting point. Take a look and see where are you in your region and the equipment. Are you the bottom? Are you the middle? Are you at the top? That's a really great place to start. And then it comes into quality of life. That's what everybody will say. If a pilot thinks that they're going to have the weekend off and then you call them Friday night and say, no, you have to go out and the family has made plans, they're going to start looking for another job. Because once you made mom mad or dad mad, if it's a lady, they're going to say, we need to have a home life. So it's a matter of figuring out how to guarantee that they have a quality of life, that when they're off, they're off, they're not being called. So that's the first thing. And then it is a total package. You look at healthcare, you look at benefits, you look at all the things. Retirement is a huge thing with the airlines right now. I think Delta's what, 16% right now they're putting into 401k. And I haven't seen the new United AIP yet, but, and you get into trouble within the companies though, because of how different management levels are classified in an HR department. So they get locked in, and sometimes there isn't the leeway for a company or a high net worth individual to do that. So they have to think out, you have to help them think out of the box and say, well, we're not necessarily classified as middle management because that's going to lock us into a salary range or a benefit range. And so it's helping managers, flight department managers, have that conversation with either the HR people or the boss to say, we need to look at this job different. And we're hearing feedback. A lot of them are, because just the way the industry is right now, we've never seen this, you know, where you just can't hire. You can't go out and hire the blonde hair, blue eye, type rated pilot with 5,000 hours. There was five of them lined up at your door. Those days are gone right now. Not that they won't come back, but they're gone right now.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, it's a very cyclical market, right? Like there is definitely a chance. I mean, just what? COVID years. It didn't look great, but now here we are making record money. So it goes to show how fast everything can just turn around and change.
It's not if, it's when. We know that. You talked to enough of your experts to know it's not if, it's when the market changes.
I mean,
when
that goes to the importance of why it's so important for pilots to lock in these contracts when they can and make their money while they can, because it's not always there as a pilot. I'm very much of make all the money you can when you can. So I totally get when people want to not necessarily rush through training, but get through it pretty quickly so they can get that seniority number and start making some money. Because if you just had the wrong timing, you could be a day off and you could not get hired by your dream airline for 5 years later, maybe longer.
Well, yeah. And remember, I lived through the 70s and 80s when the companies would open up contracts to institute B scales, rollbacks. American Eastern, we all did rollbacks. We give backs where we had a good contract, but yeah, we're good. You know, we're losing money. So they went to the workforce and we all gave back and, I think American ended up with an A, B, and C scale at one point. So it's I've seen what can happen. I've lived it. We're young guys now. I worry to get this like myopic viewpoint, like, oh, it's always good times. And then when it hits, it's going to be, you know, shocking, I think, to the system.
So you're looking back in your career right now, and let's say you're talking to someone that's 18. They are giddy to start an aviation career because they know they can make so much money right now. I feel like you've literally done everything that you can fly, that you can do. What would you maybe push someone or just recommend based on your experiences for what you've done? Like what would be one, like your favorite kind of flying that you did that you'd be like, hey, well, 121 is probably the way you should go, or be like, nah, you know, 91 is great. Like, I think if you can find the right spot, that's where you need to go.
We do an aviation day here in Daytona for Embraer students and FIT students. And so I talk to a lot of students and I tell them, because I live in Daytona, I don't know if you know that, don't lock into the airlines. You've got a long career ahead of you. And I understand the fear of missing out, but this industry is so cyclic. Go experience that. Some of the best flying I ever had was flying cargo all around the world, like going into Sonderstrom and Keflavik, overnighting in Sonderstrom in a military barracks, and just meeting people all around the world that I would have never met on an airline job. And so while Delta and the United and American and Southwest are all appealing, it's the same airports for the next 45 years. You're going to see the same airports, the same situations, the same people. Get out there and enjoy this industry. Go up and fly some of the Alaska. Go up and do some different type of flying. The business aviation. Get into it. I mean, even what you do, you think about it. How many times? Now we have Teterboro and Van Nuys and PDK. I mean, there are airports we do visit a lot, but there are a lot of airports we're going into for the first time. And like the challenge of doing that and meeting people. So I tell people and I write articles that I had friends in the airlines, acquaintances. My real friendships have come from out of business aviation. And because it is very much a relationship part of the industry. We're a one airplane, two pilot operations. So I rely on a lot of other people to help me process things and put things right now. I'm getting LOAs for international ops. So I've been pulling on a lot of friends to help walk through that process. Challenges that you will never face flying for an airline. And, you know, it's all done for you behind the scenes, but I think it makes you a better aviator. I think it makes you really love this industry to see what it is. A friend of mine, Eric, we were having a conversation the other day and he analogized. He goes, you know, the knowledge there is in all of aviation let's say it's a swimming pool full of size of knowledge filled up with water. And he goes, the average pilot probably has a cup full or even a jar full of that knowledge. But there's all this other knowledge out there that that other people are doing we don't even know about, or we have some inkling that we but we're not informed about. And so I think it's sad that if you just lock yourself into one track, you miss a lot of what else is out there. And I think it makes you a better pilot too. When you go to the airline, if you've done been out and done some freight, and you've gone out and done some cargo flying, and when you go to the airline, you just bring that with you. That knowledge base is coming with you, and they're going to appreciate it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I totally agree with that. And I mean, my goal when I first started training was to become an airline pilot. But the more I was around GA and the more I saw around GA, and I skipped, if I would have become a flight instructor, I'm pretty sure I would have gone the regional and hopefully be at a major by now. But I've just kind of fallen in love with this side of the industry. And now the money is so crazy in airline, it makes you think, you're like, I mean, I got like 30 years left, 32 years left. I could make some good money. I've already done my fun flying. I don't mind turning left, you know? It's like I do it for 30 years, get 60%. Like, it just seems great. So it's funny, even when you think you're set in your career, you know, when I got hired in 2018, I was like, I'm done, never applying ever again. But then things can change so fast. And there's a very short windows in this career where if you want to make a change, you can make a change. Because like we said, you never know when the next downturn is going to happen. And then you should just hope you're at the right spot and be happy with that decision. Wow.
And I made a change at 57. I mean, yeah, I went exactly from the business to the airline. So it's never up until, you know,
and you made a change back.
And even then, part of what we face in the business aviation world is we're encouraging folks retiring out of the airlines. Hey, come over to this side of the industry. You know, you may still be healthy. You still have a desire to fly, and we can use you. Now, you're going to have to maybe, you know, carry the toilet in and clean it and load some bags and do all the work. But if you can change that mindset, it's a very rewarding part of the industry.
Yeah, definitely. Good thing for us is I don't have to carry a toilet in. That would kind of, I don't know how I feel about that.
Been there, done that, but I don't have to do it anymore.
Yeah. Hard pass. I'm not going to fly a plane with a portable toilet that you got to clean.
or one without an APU. That's
exactly.
Kind of where I'm at, right?
Yeah, APUs, man. God bless an APU, right? Whenever we're at the MEL or APU, it's a bad, bad day.
It's not a good day. Well, I fly a Praetor right now, so we need the APU to even start the engine. So we wouldn't be going anywhere.
Yeah,
so,
gotta love that.
That was a challenge. I had never flown fly-by-wire, so yeah. This is my first fly-by-wire experience.
My company just announced they're buying a ton of Praetors, so Praetor 500. So maybe one day in my future, you never know.
Yeah, it's a great airplane.
That's what I heard.
Truly, if you get a chance, it really is a great airplane.
Yeah, so, it's a good mission, good airplane, comfortable, big. So yeah, we'll see. And I like the really side stick. It'd be cool. Makes you feel like you're an Airbus pilot or something. Does it have a tray? Can you eat your food on a tray or no tray?
It does have a tray.
Oh my
yes,
gosh.
It does.
I'd be like
a nice roomy co-pilot. And I was a Latitude pilot, so I know.
Oh, so you know
the Latitude.
All right, so tell me, what do you like more about the Latitude and vice versa? Like if you had, I guess a better question would be, if you had to choose, which one would you choose?
I choose the Praetor.
Oh, dang.
I love the Latitude. I've always a Textron and I love the Textron support system. Have a lot of good friends there. I like the Garmin avionics. I thought were very well done. Very pilot friendly. The one thing I liked about Garmin, they're adaptable. Like if there's a glaring issue, they're willing to look at it and change it. With Collins and Honeywell, and some of those are not. But the stiff wing Textron it rides rougher than the Praetor.
It's rough, man. It is a rough ride.
It's a rough ride.
Yeah,
but it's a great platform, and I really enjoyed it. The Praetor though. It's fast. It's a little bit faster. It rides so much better. Burns the same amount of fuel, and the Latitude and the XLS Plus and the Praetor all burn the same amount of fuel on our missions. It is crazy. So I'll share this with you. Back in March, we go into a little airport in Southwest Georgia. That's kind of one of our homes away from home because the boss has a plantation just north of there for the hunt quail and have horses and stuff. And we were landing one night, just the crew going in for a morning departure. And ended up hitting a deer on landing. And that was end of March. We were very fortunate. I was just touching down, and a bunch of them came across the runway, and I rotated the nose, heard the thump, like, so we hit something. Landed, taxied in. Everything was steerable. Nothing seemed to be broke. And he caught you're so fortunate. He caught the forward Wi-Fi antenna right on the belly and ripped there's a whole composite panels down there. So he ripped that antenna off and then damaged the next panel behind that, went right down the middle. So we didn't get flaps. We didn't get gear. Nothing else was damaged, but it was down for 3 months though, because they had to manufacture the parts in Brazil, those fairings. They obviously just don't have one sitting on the shelf. So we got it ferried down to Fort Lauderdale and just got the airplane back first of the month. So
that's crazy. I'll have to look into the Praetor. We have a ton of Longitudes and we have orders for a ton of Praetors. So I feel like that would be my next move. I love the Garmin avionics. I'm a Garmin guy. I would love to stay Garmin for as long as I can on the Longitude. It's nice, you know, nice, roomy, faster airplane, swept wing. So probably a little bit better in the turbulence.
It is. Trust me. And the cockpit's very roomy, same as the Latitude. And you don't have the control column, so you have that much room. You do have a table that you can pull out. And just in the columns, Avionics does a great job. I mean, I did the ProLine 21 and the XLS Plus, so that was a pretty easy transition. Not that difficult. But I think you'd really like it. It's just really.
We'll see how the seniority falls, you know? So I got to look into it.
You can always make a good landing, too.
Ooh, I like that. That's how the PC-12 was. If you had a bad landing in a PC-12, you would have crashed in any other airplane you're flying.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the Latitude sometimes would smite thee on the landing. But the Praetor does just the fly-by-wire just really does a nice job.
Yeah, the Latitude's tricky sometimes. You get in a ground effect and, you know, you're kind of on for a ride.
Yes.
And that long wing loves to fly. So if you are not on the speed you need to be, that thing is going to fly and fly and fly. So yeah, you got to be kind of on your toes on that plane.
Yeah, especially if you have low fuel. You know, if you're down to 3,000 pounds of fuel or something, it likes to float.
Definitely. And one of the selling points of that plane is it can get into some short runways, right? So you're going in light. You don't necessarily want to be any faster than you need to be.
Right. We operated one of our airports. We haven't been in there much, since we had the Praetor, 3,700 feet.
Yeah.
And it did a great job.
That plane has no problem stopping. No problem stopping. They built a phenomenal plane with a great mission. It just doesn't ride the best in turbulence. That's the only real knock I have on that airplane.
No, it does not.
But that's not the mission. The mission is to stop at a short runway and be able to take off. That's what they want. So that's what they got.
Exactly. And have a comfort cabin, which they did. I mean, the flat floor and very nice.
Yeah. Let's take a break from today's episode to hear from our sponsor, RAA. As pilots, we make getting from point A to point B look easy. Just like getting to Oshkosh, it's so much easier to fly than to drive. But if you're like me, financial planning for your future isn't always so straightforward. Fortunately, my partners at RAA created a manual for that. Their complete financial planning guide outlines the 7 key factors you'll want to consider when preparing a strong financial plan for tomorrow. In terms that are simple and direct, just the way pilots like it. Best of all, it's free. So download your complete financial planning guide today at raa.com/pilot-to-pilot. That's raa.com/pilot-to-pilot. And now back to today's episode. So talk to me a little bit about the stuff you do outside of flying. So we kind of mentioned it in the intro, but you are a president, a vice chair, operations committee. You founded an NBAA small flight program committee. So tell me a little bit of that kind of stuff. And one, why? You sound like a busy guy, right? Flying can take up a lot of time, but what was the reason? Just wanted to do more, wanted to give back, or somebody was like, hey, man, you'd be great at this, and we'll pay you too.
Yeah, well, they don't. Yeah, the pay's not good. when I was been in business aviation, and I've always been a member of NBAA, but really I hadn't plugged in anywhere. And so I sent an email, or I was actually on the message board, and said, is there a small flight department? Because we were, once again, one airplane, two pilot. And one of the staff members responded. He said, We don't have a small flight department committee, because that was always the criticism of NBAA was the National Large Business Aviation Association. And those all only represent large operators. Well, come to find out that 80% of the operating members of the National NBAA are small operators, two airplanes or less. But yet we had no representation. We didn't have a group to kind of help with the issues, because our issues are different than a large flight department. We don't have dispatchers. We don't have, a lot of times we don't have maintenance people. We have to rely on the manufacturer. So we're doing all that ourselves. So 6 years ago, we came together and we were out in Vegas and met and said, let's launch this thing, and put out on the message boards. And a bunch of people said, hey, I'll join up. So we started a small flight department subcommittee under the Domestic Operating Committee. It was the overriding authority. Had a bunch of people sign up for first year. We did a survey. We said, hey, what issues are you guys facing? So, you know, wearing so many hats, scheduling time off, all the things that we could have pretty well guessed, but they verified. Based on that survey, we started putting together training and programs. And every year we do a symposium right before base on the Monday before the convention for small operators, where we tackle a bunch of topics. We bring experts in. We've been doing that for 5 years now. I've moved on. We now have two guys, and you may know Dylan Miller. He and Max do the 21.5 podcast. If you've had a chance to listen to them.
I know the podcast, but I don't know if I actually talked to them before.
Yeah. Good. Great guys. Dylan's a good friend, and he and Joe Samadowski, who just last year started with, he's on the Sovereign.
Oh, wait, I got another fellow podcaster.
No, well, Dylan is. Joe is not a potty. Joe's just a good guy that's on the. He and Dylan are co-chairs for the small flight department. So they've expanded some of the things. They did a virtual symposium last month, end of June, on insurance and leasing and things that chief pilots need to know. And try and put tools. We have a learning system up on the website where different topics, we bring experts in and we record them. And so if I tell the story where I get a call where a guy goes, you know, I got hired by his co-pilot 6 months ago. Now I'm the chief pilot because the chief pilot just went to Delta. What do I do? And so we try and walk them through some basic things, knowledge they need to do, look at, and then we should direct them to our learning system and say, here's some experts. So we really wanted to build two things, a voice into MBAA so that they were aware of problems for small flight departments, and they responded very well. Ed Mullen's become a friend. They've opened up their eyes, and a lot of the conversations, like this SMS mandate by the FAA for 135 operators, MBAA has been really on the forefront of opening the FAA's eyes to the need for scalable SMS for small operators. And you can't, one size does not fit all. So they've been on the forefront of that, I think, because of our voice. And then I've moved into the vice chair role of the Domestic Operating Committee, which basically does anything. We deal with anything in the domestic U.S. airspace, 135 operators, 125 operators, Part 91 small flight operators. And now we have emerging tech ATC group that is now on board. And we're talking about adding a training subcommittee that will deal with training issues for the 142 schools. So it keeps me busy. But once again, I love it because it's giving back to the community. It helps me. Like I said, I've built great relationships working on that. I want to encourage anybody, if you're Part 91 or 135 or 125, come and join us. I've learned so much, things that I never know. We do monthly calls on different committee topics, and we get briefings about what the FAA is dealing with. And because we have staff members that are meet with the FAA on a pretty regular basis, the senior level. So, things that I would have never known were happening. So I encourage you, you know, if anybody wants to shoot me a note or shoot connect, and I'll send you the application and come join us. The pay is lousy, but the fun is good. I'll tell you about that. So that wasn't enough. So 3.5 years ago, met with some friends here in Orlando and said, We don't have a regional group. Have we ever thought about forming a regional group for business aviation? And we said, well, we don't know. Let's see if anybody's interested. So we bought some beer and we invited people to the airport and fed them some beer and some sandwiches and said, okay, what do you think is what we're thinking? Anybody, think it's a great idea? And the whole room said, let's do it. So we formed the Central Florida Business Aviation Association. We are of over 420 members now. We do monthly happy hours all around the region. I just saw where the Yo Pros are doing an axe throwing event coming up. So I'm like, what could happen? What could possibly go wrong with alcohol and axes, right? And then our big event, like I told you, every spring now, we do what we call an aviation day, where we set up vendors and bring in airplanes and we have speakers and we invite students from Embry-Riddle, FIT, all the colleges, all the high schools. The first year we had probably 150 students came. But this last spring we had over 400 students. And I think this next year we'll probably have more. They saw after the first year how well it was done, and I think everybody's going to get on board. And what was exciting was we had not just the first year, we had a lot of pilots, and we had a couple of pilots got direct hire out of that event, interviewed and offered positions flying. This year we had a lot of management, engineering, and maintenance people that came looking for those careers. Which was exciting because we had people here looking for all of those positions. So I think next year is even going to be a better event.
What have you learned? Because a lot of people just fly, right? So what have you learned in any of these side ventures, I guess I'll call them, that you couldn't have learned in an actual airplane itself? Is there anything, or is there a lot of stuff that has made you either a better pilot or just forming better relationships with everything else you've been doing?
All the above. I think I'm a better pilot, but I think more important, especially being a manager of a department, but even then, I have great relationships with experts in the safety field. So they've opened my eyes to, okay, how to operate safely. What does that mean? We just had a conversation, we had a huge 2-day event where I did the virtual calls with experts on the usefulness of a frat and is it really a useful tool? And what was interesting was that by the end of the 2, and these are experts, these are people in the safety field, all said the checklist frat is the most useless thing we have probably right now in the safety field. It really isn't helping. I don't know what type of frat that Jets uses, but typically it was a checklist or you assigned a value for the different conditions. And I said, well, it seems like a game. Like I'm going to make the value so I don't fall into the yellow or the red so I can go. Is this really a safety tool? So we're restructuring what that conversation looks like. What does it mean to evaluate a flight before you actually go? And now we're venturing into how is AI going to help that process. There's a company called Polaris, which is rolling out a system that is going to utilize AI that you will go in and put your flight in. And because it's stored all of your flight data, all the weather, all the airport information, that it can analyze all that for you and give you a readout that says, hey, here's some things you might want to look at. Here's some safety issues based on your flight manual, the AIP, the weather, the FARs. Duty times, whatever. So we're going to see AI creeping into safety and dispatch and those types of things. So those conversations have started. Regulations, how the meat grinding of how regulations come about and how our voices affected that. Like I said, we've got staff members at NBA that meet regularly with senior FAA officials. So they come back and, hey, this is what the FAA is thinking about changing or doing. What are your thoughts? And we can feed right back into the highest levels of the FAA what our concerns or agreements are. Training is one of the things in the Part 91 world. And your guys are different because you're doing progressive training, right?
We do AQP now. So we are
AQP, right?
Yeah. So we're the only corporate kind of department. It's kind of hard to label us, right? Like we do so much, but we are the only 135, 91, 91K that offers AQP.
Right, which is great. AQP is a great training tool. The FAA came out last couple months ago and dictated to the 142 schools, though, that we used to do progressive checks, where if you were Part 91, you would go in, if it was a TCA, a check airman, he could, as you accomplish tasks, steep turns, stalls, whatever, they would just sign you off, right? And then you wouldn't have to go back and do them again. And the FAA said, well, that's not how the FARs are written. You have to truly test them. So, which means now we have to go back to train and then test. But our feeling is that we waste a whole day by doing that, where we could be doing circling approaches or things that we know are causing accidents, runway excursions in our industry. And so that raised its head here a couple months ago, and we've been in conversations with NBA, with FAA, and they've got, yeah, we think you guys are right, so we need to rewrite the 8900 so that we can get back to doing that. So that's a case where we've been involved in the conversation. We brought it up. We are going to effectively change for the better for our industry. Circling approaches. You've been around the last couple of years, you've seen, you know, how many accidents have we had with circling approaches? How do we train for those? Well, it's Memphis or JFK, right? Well, and that's not real. That's not how many times we do. So we want to change how we do circling or train for circling approaches. So that's been the conversation. The FAA is very intrigued and seems to be willing to look at it and help make some adjustments to that.
I hope if anyone at FAA is listening and they want some of my recommendations, I highly recommend we do the circle that we do most often, which for us, and I'm guessing if you fly the Chicago area, will be Pulwalkie when you are leaning 1-8 and doing the circle to 3-6 or 1-6. I haven't flown in like three weeks, so forgetting all the runways. But that circle's dangerous. Like there's a lot of airspace right there. O'Hare's right there. A lot of pilots get violated because they just don't judge the winds right. There's not a lot of room to make that turn, and it gets really windy in Chicago, and a lot of times it shifts to where you're going to have to do that circle, and it's a real pain in the butt. I honestly think that's the circle that needs to be taught and trained, because that's the one you're going to fly. There's all the other ones, you're never going to do a circle into Memphis, never going to do a circle to Indy, JFK, never, ever.
No.
So do the one that we actually need, and that's Pulwalkie, or get rid of it. Figure out a way that we can have an RMP, one of the two. But that needs
to
change.
That's what we've been moving to. That's been the conversation over the last year, has been with all of the equipment we now have on board our airplanes, why can't we come up with some kind of an instrument-guided visual approach? And that's what the FAA is working on. They've Honeywell rolled out the one for Teterboro. The FAA is looking at it to see how that works. And I just was on a call the other day, and the FAA is going to roll out a guided visual approach to Aspen, which will get you lower and more stabilized.
Yeah, so we have our own visual approach that's been approved. So I wonder if it's the same one. I wonder if maybe they've taken ours and just kind of implemented it.
Very likely, could be. But that's been our. We have the technology, so let's leverage it. And the FAA is starting to move in that direction, where visual circling approaches may someday be out the window. Although you think, you know, so many small airports we go into is fractional and charter and Part 91, they're not going to hit every airport.
No,
America's Georgia will probably never have a guided visual circling approach.
Yeah. And I mean, but like PDK, right? So those antennas, like obviously like an RMP would be great there. Pulwalkie,
exactly.
There's certain big airports, and not everyone could do RMP. So like you said, maybe make them visual. But there's some certain airports that are definitely trickier than others that we go into more times than not. Aspen, 100%. I hate Aspen. If I could never go there again, I'd be happy.
Fortunately, I haven't had to go in there in quite a while. And I don't miss it.
I've been there like three times in my whole career.
But I also think one of the contributing factors, and I was on Dylan's podcast when the guy crashed out in San Diego, or the trucky one, as pilots, are we losing the ability to fly visually? And I wonder about that with all the technology, and I see it as an old fart. I see it even with my younger co-pilot, that when his head is so much inside and operating when we're cleared for visual or something, and sometimes I'll say, just kick the autopilot off and fly it, hand fly it. And he's resident to do that. And so I think that's a train. That's something that we've talked about with the training centers, that we need to probably practice that a little bit more, like set you up on a downway or set you up on a situation and just say, okay, hand fly it. Don't program anything. Just do it. Do a nice visual approach. Just to, we all learned it, right? In basic, then we just need to, I was telling one guy, put the end of the runway. Didn't you ever learn this? Put the end of the runway in the middle of the windshield and just fly to it. And he goes, oh, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. I mean, I am, so I'm waiting for IOE right now. So I'll start being a captain on the line, and I'll be awesome. Flying with some younger pilots. And I'm sure I've heard from other people, not all of them, right? Some of them have really good stick and rudder skills. So maybe not all of them, but I've definitely heard that some people, it's like, why don't you just hand fly the airplane? And they're like, what do you mean hand fly the airplane? It's like, oh boy. And I don't know if this is like a training factor from day one, like where they're in G1000s, some of them autopilots, and it's just easy to use, and they just rely on them a little bit. Or if it's maybe it's an IOE thing, they're training to be on the automation more, because that's just, it's FOQA's better. Our FOQA data says that's safer. So I don't know if there's something that just needs to be taught, that visuals are very important to learn how to fly. I mean, you look at the San Francisco accident when they were flying a visual, and it could happen to anyone, right? Big planes, exactly. Small planes. So yeah, you got to have your skills. So,
definitely. And I think it is a skill that can wane if you don't practice it.
Oh, for sure. So and you get nervous too, right? Because you're not going to be as good. And you're like, all right, well, if the plane can fly it already, then why would I fly it if I know the plane's going to do it better? So I think, yeah, it's tough. I always try to hand fly as much as I can. Just because I don't want to be in that position to where I don't think I can fly as good as the autopilot, you know, like I want to be able to fly better. So
exactly. Yeah. I think that's a good philosophy.
Yeah. Well, hey, I have some rapid fire questions for you. Sure. So these are gonna be very quick. Try not to explain your answer. Just the very first thing that comes in your head, just say the question or say the answer. Then I'll go on to the next question. Sound good?
Yeah, go for it.
All right. What's your favorite airplane ever made? Or actually, what's your favorite airplane you've ever flown?
727.
What's your favorite GA airplane you've ever flown?
The Praetor.
Ooh, there you go. Love it. A lot of Praetor love today.
It is. Yeah. I was skeptical going in, but I really love, I've come to love the airplane.
That's the best kind of way. What's the ugliest airplane you've ever seen?
HansaJet.
Something you wish you knew. Yeah. I'm a Piaggio. I'm an anti-Piaggio guy, but the HondaJet's not my favorite either. What's something you wish you knew before you became a pilot?
I probably wish I'd known I wish I'd known how to pick an airline better back in the day.
If you would have been back in the day and say you would have chose United, do you think you would have never ever left the airlines?
Yeah, I would. Well, like I said, I had an offer between American and Eastern. American had a big B scale, and
yeah.
American is what has been bankrupt but twice, I think, since then. So I would have lost all my retirement and those four folks. But yeah, who knows, right?
Yeah. Who is someone in the industry you would like to meet most?
Current or past?
Could be either one.
I said Charles Lindbergh. Like, gosh, you got on that airplane not knowing that you're going to make it. That was just,
it's not a good feeling. Sure. Yeah, I don't like those
guys. I had the opportunity to meet my hero, though. I'll tell this story quick, and I know it's just supposed to be rapid fire, but growing up in the 60s, 70s, obviously the space program, and my father got us up so we could watch the Neil Armstrong land on the moon and walk on the moon, and ended up naming our middle school after Neil Armstrong. He was always my hero. And I'm not, and you're in this industry, you do it all the time. We fly very famous people, right? They're just stars and politicians, and I've flown them all. And I'm never starstruck. I don't really care. You put your pants on the same way I do, get in the airplane. And for the most part, they love just being treated as normal people. And I had the opportunity, I was a citation chair, and we were picking up Neil Armstrong, his wife, and flying him and them down to Augusta, Georgia to go play golf or something at the Masters. And I told him, I said, I am starting. He was a very nice man. And I said, I just want to tell you, you are my absolute hero. I always felt that. And he was the nicest person.
That's awesome.
He said, oh, let's get a picture taken. And I still have that picture on my phone today.
Just, I love that.
So I got to meet him. So that's why I said Charles Lindbergh.
I love that. That's amazing. Let's see. What is your favorite thing about aviation?
The relationships.
What's the worst, your least favorite airport? One that you get on your flight or in your schedule and you're just like, no, not again.
Arcadia, Florida.
Okay.
It was a 3,700 foot runway.
Yeah, that doesn't sound too. give me 4,000. You know, at a minimum, please.
Yeah, really with a hump in the middle. Yeah.
What's your favorite airport?
Favorite airport? I probably would have to say. I don't know. I'm weird. I enjoy Teterboro. I enjoy just seeing all the activity in Teterboro.
Teterboro seems like it's like it's just like home, you know? Like I like the
yes.
I actually really love New York controllers. Like you just listen to them and you will be perfectly fine as soon as you do something that's out of the ordinary and makes them kind of you stand out to them. It's game over. It's a bad day. But if you can just follow what they're saying, keep up with the speed of how they're talking, you'll be good.
I was on a call, it was a call the other day, and I don't know if you knew that they Philadelphia Approach was supposed to take over the Newark and Teterboro airspace.
Oh, no, I didn't.
That had been in the works for a while because of Manning at the N90 with the New York TRACON, but we were just told the other day that that's not going to happen. New York TRACON will keep it. So.
I think it's for the best because I feel like New York needs to have operate. Like Teterboro gets into the way of a lot of major airports, so you need someone that knows exactly how it's going, and you got to do stuff at a certain time. You have to have the knowledge to do that. So, yeah, I'm glad.
I'll tell you my favorite New York Approach story. We were doing, when I first went with Eastern, we were doing this. You always got junior. So I was New York based. We were doing the shuttle, right? Eastern had every hour we'd fly 727 from LaGuardia to Washington National. One would leave National and go to LaGuardia. And then they did a Boston shuttle also. And I was in the middle of the day. It was beautiful. Northeast day, not a cloud in the sky. We're taking off out of Washington National, headed back to LaGuardia, taking off on 3-6. Back then it was 3-6 out of National. I think it's 1 now. Landing the expressway 3-1 at LaGuardia. And so the captain says, I think we can break the record today. What he meant was take off to touchdown. And I think it was like 28 minutes or something was the standing record. And so I'm the engineer on the 727. So I'm sitting in the backseat. And they were at like New York TRACON, and he's doing like as fast as it'll go, like 360. I mean, he just had it floored at 8,000 feet. And the New York guy comes on and he goes, Eastern 1521, and say your speed. Told the co-pilot, Tom, 250. Told the co-pilot, 250. He said, so the controller goes, say your speed again. He said, 250. And never missed a beat. He goes, Eastern 1521, slow to 80 knots. The captain goes, we were going to break the record. And he goes, I figured that, but I got a guy in front of you that I'm cutting in and it's just not going to work out. But that's the typical New York control. He wasn't mad. He was, it was just, slow to 80 knots.
Yeah, he's like, this guy, what's this guy doing right now? Slow down, bro.
Exactly. I love them.
I do love that. New York's the best, man. Great controllers.
They really are.
Would you rather fly IFR or VFR?
VFR.
What's your go-to airport food? So let's say you're at a small podunk airport and you get a crew car. What are you looking for?
Hamburger. I always check out their hamburger. See how good their hamburger is.
Would you rather fly over mountains, beaches, or the city?
I'm a beach guy.
Airbus or Boeing?
Oh, I'm a pretty much a Boeing guy, but I'm telling you, Airbus.
Like the side stick. I don't know.
I know. And at Eastern, we had the original A300s. I don't know if you remember that.
Uh-uh.
That were not side stick. And they had an engineer seat. So I was an engineer on an Airbus A300 for about a year. Dang. The easiest job in the industry because it was all automatic. You didn't have to do anything.
That's amazing. You're like, this is great. I like this whole gig, man.
Well, you had to fix the movie projectors back then.
That's funny.
That was about it.
Long trips or short trips? So like the longest trip you can fly in a Praetor or as many trips as you could do in a duty time?
Oh, I'm probably more of short trips.
Okay.
I get bored in a long trip.
Hardest check ride.
Yeah, flight engineer on a 727.
Ooh.
Hardest check ride you'll ever take. Everybody will agree to that. Yeah. Too, if they've ever taken it.
That's funny.
Back then you had to, and I don't know about this, you would have to, the oral, they went through every switch and every gauge and you had to tell the limitations, what it did, how it operated. And Eastern made you, you would have to, they would blindfold you and you would have to move your hands and touch things so that you knew what, where the switches were. And then the check ride was you a single engine. You lost two engines, so you had to crank gear, dump fuel, do cards, transfer. It was all while you were in the pattern before they landed. It was a tough check ride.
Yeah, thank goodness I don't have to do that. Very happy.
Yeah, really.
Yeah. What's the biggest regret of your career, if you have one?
Should I gone with American rather than Eastern? That's probably, I often think of that. But
what's the biggest win in your career so far?
That's a good question because it's been just a great career. I mean, yeah. I've enjoyed every bit of it.
We can go with the whole thing. Probably can't. That. The whole shebang.
Yeah. The whole shebang.
Yeah. Piper or Cessna?
Cessna.
141 training versus 61 training. If someone came up to you today saying like, hey, my goals are blah, 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 or I want to be a pilot, what should I go down?
I think 141 training. I like 61 only because I think it's more personal, but I think if the 141 going to prepare you better for the industry.
Cool. We're almost done, so it's all good. I just have one more question for you. And it's someone listening to this podcast right now. They come up to you like, hey, if you could give me just three tips of advice for having a good career in aviation, what would it be?
Three tips I would give them. Number one, never burn a bridge. Always build good relationships because you never know when you're going to have to go back over the bridge. Number two, always be learning. There are so many guys that don't pick up a wood. Once they get their job, they stop learning. There's so many periodicals, so much information. Get involved. Number three, get involved in some sort. If you're with an airline, get involved with union work or safety work or something. Get involved with the association because that's where you're going to build relationships. Number two, your knowledge base is going to grow. It's going to make you a better pilot, better person. And you'll just enjoy the job so much better.
I love it. Well, Dave, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. I appreciate your time and just your plethora. There we go. Got it. Nailed it. Of just knowledge in so many sections.
The BS level. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, right. So,
Hey, it's my pleasure. And anytime, I'd be glad to. And I have a LinkedIn page. People can connect with me. Love to connect with people.
All right. Well, sounds good. Well, I appreciate it. And we'll be in touch. That's a wrap on today's episode. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, leave a review. Like I said, 5 stars would be great. Spotify, iTunes. If you've done it before, do it again. Just kidding. I didn't say that. But I hope you enjoyed this episode. Seriously, it was a lot of fun talking with Dave and just hearing his story and what he's gone through and the things that he's done has been amazing. So shout out, Dave. This is amazing. Thanks for coming on. So Aviation, that's all I got for you today. And as always, happy flying.